Dr. Jiu Zhangping, thank you very much for that excellent lecture. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm very pleased to be with you today. I must introduce you, myself to you, not as a scholar on this subject. You will hear today from me a very practical view of the relationship between religion and government. By way of explanation, I was introduced as being the former governor of the state of Utah. I served as governor for 11 years. It was a privilege. Utah is a state where one religion is predominant among its people. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, of which I am a member, occupies a very large percentage of the population. Consequently, there is always a concern about what is the relationship between the church and the state. I had very early in my time as governor a discussion about this very subject with the then leader of the church, Gordon B. Hinckley. He said to me, "This is often a concern to people." So he said, "Governor, I have a proposal." He said, "You run the state, and we'll run the church." And I will tell you that in 11 years, that's exactly the way it worked. There were very few occasions on which I had any contact. In most of those cases, I initiated the contact. However, I did become very aware of the profound impact that not just one church, but all churches had on the fabric of our community. One of the functions of a state government in our country is to administer the social welfare programs, health care for the poor, for example, assistance to families in need, child welfare and protection. And when one is the governor of a state, you become very intimate with those problems and how they function. So it was not very long before I came to understand how integral the work that churches do at every level in supporting the social welfare programs, not of the government, but of the people. A very difficult problem that I faced as I became governor was the problem of children who were being abused. As governor, on several occasions, I went with social workers employed by the state to homes where a report had been given that a child may not be treated according to our standards. It's a very difficult job. I stood on the porch of a home and listened to the caseworker talk with the parent and say to them, "I need to speak with your children alone. There's been a report that they may not be treated," and saw the look in the eye of the parent, that learning to balance what the right of a parent is with the right of a child to be protected is a difficult proposition for any government. But there are, on occasions, moments when it is necessary for the state to act in a way as to take a child into their own protection because they're not being protected by their parent. Now, I have come to understand that any government is a poor excuse as a substitute for loving parents. But there are times when that must occur. In our government, we came to understand that the best thing for us to do would be to find others who could, for a temporary moment, take that child into their home and give them shelter and protection and nurturing while the problem with their own parents was worked through. We called this relationship a foster family, someone to temporarily take a child and to help while they have this problem worked through with the state. The dilemma I faced as governor was I could not attract, through all of our efforts, enough people willing to do this very difficult job of taking children into their family. We tried every possible modality to recruit them, and we were not successful in identifying enough or people of the quality that we needed. I went to the churches, invited the leaders of all of the church denominations in our state, and asked them to come to my office as governor. I described for them this problem and said, these are not just citizens of the state. These are children who are members of your church or for whom you have some responsibility as well. And I need your help. I asked them to go to their congregations and to ask their congregational members if they would volunteer for service as a foster family. Now, I'm happy to tell you that they responded vigorously. At every level and in every denomination, we were able to place more families and train them and had a great success. Now, I learned from that and many other experiences in my role as governor one important principle, and that is that people will respond to people making a request to whom they pay their tithes and their offerings far more readily than they will those to whom they pay their taxes. I found that there was a very important component for a public servant to learn, that if I wanted to find where the energy was within my community, that I needed to turn to organizations such as churches who could reach out and touch the hearts of people, not just their wallet. I saw this in many, many different ways. After 11 years as governor, the President of the United States has indicated, who had also been a governor, asked if I would join his cabinet. One of the reasons that I was interested to serve at that level was that I knew that as a governor, our president, President Bush, had observed many of the same things I had. He had seen that there are literally armies of compassionate people willing to be deployed into communities if they are, in fact, deployed on problems. He had also observed, as had I, that there was a natural reluctance at times for churches to deal with governments and for governments to deal with churches. And yet we were, as in this child welfare problem, dealing with the same people and worrying about the same problems. The president decided he wanted to change this as president and concluded he would launch what he has called his faith-based initiatives. It was a very direct strike at changing the culture of our government, not to take over religion, but to partner with religion in dealing with the citizens we both serve in unique and different ways. His first executive order was to create the Office of Faith-Based Initiatives. Now, as a member of his cabinet, operating the Department of Health and Human Services, particularly in the area of human services, administering that has fallen to my responsibility. Now, I'd like to tell you just a little bit about my responsibility as Secretary of Health and Human Services. It is the largest single budget in our government. It is roughly one out of every four federal dollars administered in the Department of Health and Human Services. Most of those dollars are spent in the area of health care for the elderly or health care for the poor. But a significant part of our department's responsibility is to help those who are in need, particularly needy families or those who have some problems such as substance abuse or others, otherwise. I'd like to just tell you about some of the experiences that I have had as Secretary of Health and Human Services in seeing this interaction between government and faith-based organizations. Our nation, like any nation, has a significant population of people who find themselves entangled in the tragedy and hardship of substance abuse. It is in the interest of our country to help them extract themselves. And over the course of many years, our government has had programs where we would try to get people into a recovery program, and we will in some cases even pay for it. We have felt always that there was a place in recovery for a person to not just change their behavior, but to change their heart. Because when you change a person's heart, you begin to change their behavior. Now, this is not a place for the state necessarily to become involved. And yet we recognize that there is a need for people to have this kind of personal change when they're making this kind of recovery. So we initiated a program as part of this faith-based initiatives. We call it Access to Recovery. And we have changed the culture of the way we operate by rather than just paying the program and having us and government choose the program, we have given vouchers to different to the actual recipient themselves, and they get to choose a program. And what that's done is two things. One is that it has allowed those who would choose a faith-based program to do so. And the second thing is that it gives us some level of accountability because we're able to compare the results among those who choose, and we've begun to hold organizations accountable. And we set a goal that we would have 125,000 people who would be in this Access to Recovery. I'm happy to tell you it's been a very popular and extremely successful endeavor. We have had more than 200,000 who have sought this out and who have chosen faith-based organizations, and I will tell you that the results among the faith-based organizations, predictably, in my judgment, have been higher than those otherwise. Another dilemma that we face in every state in the country is that many of our people break the law and through the judicial system are incarcerated. But their prison sentence ends, and then they go back into society. It's a hard integration for people. In many cases, they don't have family support. It's hard for them to find a job. They come out of prison with basically the clothes on their back, a little bit of money that the state gives them, and very quickly they find their way back into trouble because they have no pathway to recovery. Again, we have reached out to faith-based organizations, and we have given competitively bid contracts to say to them, if you will take these nonviolent prisoners by the hand and help them through the process, we'll pay you, and in the long run, we come out much, much better because we have substantially less recidivism. We have successfully now integrated many states' programs in faith-based organizations. Another dilemma that most states deal with is that when prisoners leave their home, it leaves a large gap. And there are children of prisoners who need guidance. There are 2 million children in the United States who have one or more parent who are incarcerated. They have needs that are very unique. And again, just like with the foster families, they need adults, people who care for them, who can reach out and find out what their needs are. And government is a fairly ineffective substitute for people who can be mentors on a day-to-day basis. So we have reached out to faith-based organizations and other community organizations and said to them, if you will create mentoring programs we will support that effort. We think that we see the direct result of it. I'm happy to say that we now are mentoring over 100,000 children of prisoners through faith-based organizations. Another problem is homelessness. Obviously, there are many who are chronically homeless in our country as well as others. We've established through our Department of Housing and Urban Affairs programs where we have, again, faith-based organizations who will take a person who is chronically homeless, take them by the hand, work them through the process of finding a home, and then check back with them. It's a very logical approach. I can tell you that we have 12% fewer people who are chronically homeless today than we did when we started this. Over 20,000 people have been put into homes into permanent housing situations. Now, if you were to ask me what is the most significant surprise you have received as Secretary of Health, I would tell you it's the amount of work I do internationally. I have been working in the last 4 years in more than 40 different countries. So I've interacted with the health minister or the social minister in many of your countries. One of the purposes of my visits have been the administration of an effort the United States has developed called the President's Initiative on AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR, as we refer to it. We have committed $15 billion as a nation to helping to treat and to establish medical infrastructure in places where SARS ravages nations. We've chosen 15 different nations to do that. But it's impossible for us to be there to do it. And so we've reached out looking for community organizations to help us administer that. Well, very quickly we discovered, for the very same reason, that if we contract with faith-based organizations, they have the capacity to reach into communities that many others do not. I was in Egypt a couple of weeks ago, and one of my important visits was to visit the head of the Ethiopian Orthodox Church. This is a church of some 40 million members. They have 400,000 clergy, and they have been our greatest strength in Ethiopia in being able to administer PEPFAR. Why? Because, as the head of the church said to me, I have an army, he used that term, of 400,000 members of the clergy, and they're prepared to teach and to do all they can in their churches about the importance of preventing AIDS, of being tested for AIDS, and being treated. And we want very much to support that. There was a problem in Ethiopia because many people were skeptical of the medical treatment. They thought it was being administered to them and that, in fact, that was causing them to get sick. We could not overcome that until we went to the faith-based organizations, said to the head of the church, will you help us solve this problem? They had a belief that they, part of their religious tradition, is that they could go to a place where holy water was given to them. It was part of their religious behavior. And the head of the church said, I want to make certain people know that they're compatible. It solved the problem. Why? Because they spoke to their hearts. And there was skepticism about what was going on with their government. I've seen that all over the world. I've seen it in times of disaster. Shortly after I became secretary, in one of my we had Katrina, which was the largest and most substantial natural disaster our country has ever endured. Nearly 4 million people were displaced. My responsibility was to organize places where those who had been driven from their homes could stay. I spent nearly 4 weeks going from city to city, meeting in large stadiums where thousands of people for a time had been put up in bunks, or I went to other places. But the most important thing I saw was the response of the churches. I went to the state of Arkansas. I went to the governor's office where I saw a command center had been set up in the room next to the governor's office. He said, I was told that I had 12 hours and that I could expect, I think it was a number like 20,000 people who would be evacuees, and I needed to find a place to put them. He said, I picked up the phone and called the churches. He said, I knew they all had church camps where they had organized their for their youth. And they opened their camps and instantly had them organized, not just with a place for them to stay, but people there who could help them and greet them. It was a powerful demonstration of what can occur when organizations from the community who care deeply about their about the same people go into action. I have seen literally armies of organized churches go into communities and help extract people from rubble. I've seen them deliver to them kits of supplies. All of these things are matters that would be very difficult for any government to maintain capacity to do. Again, I am not a scholar when it comes to religion and government, but I am a practitioner, and I have seen it in very practical ways. Just a little bit about how our faith-based initiatives have come in total. In the last year alone, the federal government provided 19,000 direct competitive awards in total the categories I've talked about. You'll be interested to know that 3,200 of them went to faith-based organizations. That's a dramatic increase over several years ago. My point is that we are beginning to rely more and more on faith-based organizations because of the powerful impact that they can have in unique ways. It's not only the federal government now that has begun to adopt this strategy. There are now 35 states who have faith-based initiatives. I might add that this is not one political party or the other. There are 19, I believe, states among that 35 that are from the Democrat Party, and there are the balance, 16, that are from Republicans. I have noted that both of our presidential candidates in the upcoming election have indicated a support to enhance and improve and expand faith-based initiatives. This has become a very important part of the way we deliver human services. Now, I think it would be important, again, to just ask the question, why? I'd like to reflect for you what I think I have learned from this. When I was a young boy, my grandmother, in a little town in about a state away from here, would always make bread. And whenever I would go to her home, there would be my grandmother kneading the bread, and she had a large bowl with a, I just remember it being a beige bowl with a blue stripe. And she would take that dough out, and she'd divide it into small pans for the bread. And then she would set it on the table in the sun. And all of you know what happens when you set bread dough in the sun on a warm day. The yeast begins to work, and it begins to expand. There is leaven in the loaf. I've come to understand and believe that faith-based organizations and other community organizations can be the leaven in the loaf, and that it can take any society and bring out of it its best and begin to expand its heart. Because the truth is, every nation is the aggregate of the hearts of its people. And if one is able to change the heart of any one person, you have changed the nation. And one improves a nation. One gains harmony within a nation by unifying the hearts of the people. I would suggest to you that religion and government should always be maintained as separate. But religious freedom and a religious right is not just in the interest of the people, it is in the interest of the nation. It is the leaven in the loaf. And I look forward to hearing a report of your conversation. It's a very important meeting, and I'm glad you've invited me to participate. Thank you.